podcast, and I'm your host, Pietro Polsinelli. In this episode, we're with Sebastian Detterling, and the theme of the podcast is gamification and games. So listeners will find links to Sebastian's works in the podcast notes. So hi, Sebastian.
Hi there. So, as for myself, so if you don't know me, I'm currently a researcher, actually PhD student, finishing PhD student, hopefully soon, at Hamburg University in Germany. And at the same time, the weird circumstances that gamification thingy made a quite substantial hype curve in the past years led to the fact that I'm in parallel juggling quite a number of design projects right now around that. And before I started my PhD, I actually worked as an interaction designer, so that actually makes a bit of sense.
Okay, great. And now, my first question is that about the fact that your writing and talks touch many themes, and they relate to software user interface and usability design somehow. So somehow you managed to link considerations from anthropology, psychology, with the UI design. I mean, and how did this come about? I mean, how did it occur to you to link these fields?
It started when I was working in Germany at the Federal Agency for Civic Education. Mm-hmm. And we were doing what was back then the most popular e-voting tool or e-democracy tool online in Germany, called Wahl-O-Mat, Vote Match, in English. And the idea there would be that for every election, we would make a little tool which would basically collect questions regarding the current campaigns of the various parties. So issues like, should marijuana be legalized or something like that? Mm-hmm. And we would collect 30 questions, and the parties would answer these questions, say yes, no, or we don't know. And then the tool itself would just present the user these questions, and the user could say yes, no, maybe. And in the end, see where the user would stand with his own political views with regard to the party. So how close are you from that party? How far away are you in your actual political position from the other party? Mm-hmm. And that tool was so successful, we found, because it was playful, because the first thing that people did was basically go through the question bit by bit to find out which party they're most aligned to. But then the second and the third and the follow-up usages were all playful. They were all, now let's see which party I get if I answer no to everything, or now let's see whether I can second guess the position of that party, and let's see whether I can come as close as possible to that party in my answering. Okay. So they were turning the whole thing into play or into a game for themselves, and that made that tool so successful and so engaging. And that kind of piqued my interest and said, huh, is there a way in which we can do this intentionally, systematically?
So it wasn't because it was built in the interface, something that you discovered, something that the players, the users themselves built on that UI.
Yeah, something they did with the UI where they were basically showing to us in their usage that they say, actually, what you build here, which has a clear purpose, also has a potential for playing around with. And we're actually relishing that potential. And so therefore that was for me then as the designer or program manager, the realization to say, can I also, it's kind of, If that was a lucky hit that users showed us what they did with the tool, can you as a designer design more intentionally for that kind of playful engagement happening? So that was kind of the first aha moment. And the second aha moment was, given that the organization I was working in that was putting out this tool, was a federal agency as part of the Ministry of the Interior, there were, deep constitutional issues for us, really constitutional law issues, which is, would anybody playing this tool or using this tool see the end result as a voting recommendation or not? If they would see it as a clear voting recommendation, then basically an agency that belongs to the Ministry of the Interior would have put out a tool that would give people a voting recommendation. Even though if we didn't directly say you should vote this party or that, their interaction with the tool would result in a voting recommendation, and that would have been unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
So we were spending a lot of time and doing a lot of design work around the final results screen, and how could we design the final results screen so that people would not take the final result as, this is the party you're most aligned with, therefore you should vote for it. So these two things, the one thing, playful engagement is something that gets people involved in something supposedly as dry as politics. And secondly, small design changes in something like the final results screen might have significant effects on the perception of people and on the kind of follow-up actions that they take, as in would they take this as a voting recommendation or not. And kind of these two moments
mm-hmm.
were for me kind of the realization, this is actually something I'd like to pursue both professionally and academically.
And did you have a chance to revise that software, or you moved on from there?
I moved on from there. I worked there 3 years, and basically, also because of the political situation, there was no easy way in which you could, in reality, tinker around with the tool a lot, just because the political observation and pressure
strains
was very strong. Yeah.
Okay. And so the fact that you were wondering about these behaviors, I mean, where did you get the intellectual tools? Because these are, I mean, in evaluating this kind of behavior, you're not using usual software engineering tools or programming tools, and not even what we call design tools in a aesthetic in a strictly aesthetic sense. So you clearly needed some conceptual tools from other fields. And were you ready for that, or did you do specific studies?
I think I just bunched together what I knew, in that I spent my whole youth as a pen and paper and live action role player.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, got interested in game studies back when they were very young, and kind of, okay, is there any kind of academic writing on role-playing in general? And if you start to look at the academic writing around role-playing at that point in time, you basically go back to kind of early sociological works in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Surrounding, so basically Gary Ellen Fine writing about pen and paper role playing using Irving Goffman as a sociologist and as a sociological theory to approach that. And so that was basically where I was coming from and what I was starting to use to think about, about playing and games as the kind of starting point. And then from there, it was, I don't know, since my first academic training is in comparative literature anyhow, which is basically just a useful excuse to read novels for 5 years and call that an education. Or a beautiful excuse basically to go wild across all kinds of disciplines and just read what you find interesting and then do some kind of comparison between the two. I had a kind of more humanities background once I started to look at these matters.
So, in fact, one impression one gets from your talks is that you're sort of creating your own field. I mean,
I would say I'm rather part of that movement, because if you look into game studies as a burgeoning field, as a still young field, which is now what, 10, 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is making it up as they go along, and everyone is basically just importing whatever they find useful and interesting from their other academic backgrounds, be that media psychology, be that sociology, be that literature. What I notice more and more, and which I find more and more encouraging, is that if you look into the kind of the early game studies, it was a very kind of formalist, media-centric way of looking at video games, right? Like a film study guy or like a literature guy would look at a book or at a movie and say, okay, how is that movie composed? How is that book composed? And how does that specific composition have certain effects on the reader? And you were very much, game studies was very much about kind of describing, formalizing games as objects and artifacts. And now what you find is kind of a shift towards play, towards, oh, actually, people are also in the picture and people are doing something with these games, and what people do with them and how they perceive the games is also important. And so, just like I bring in anthropology and sociology to look at this kind of thing, like in the case of the vote match, the Valomat, right? That people somehow decided, now I'm going to stop using this instrumentally to find out something about parties and use it playfully. Like, I'm interested in these kinds of phenomena. Game studies as a whole field, still growing, also does this kind of, now let's expand our scope and look at playing as well. So yes, I'm making it up, but I'm part of a happy bunch making it all up as we go along.
Well, yes, I get it now. But in fact, for somebody I've been studying, I mean, trying to understand something about game design, game studies, in the last 2 years only, but it's very surprising how wide the field is.
And yeah.
In fact, one of the approaches which I found most useful has been a non-approach, like that of Jesse Schell, through his The Art of Game Design, which is a sort of minimalistic lens-by-lens approach. Because it seems to like a beginning game designer, it seems hard to find like an overall reference work which sort of gives you coordinates. But it seems that there are many different directions, and which I think it's I'd like to hear what's your opinion about this.
I think that speaks to the difference between academics and practitioners again, right? What Jesse Schell wrote is a very good book for practitioners who are interested in building and designing games, whereas most other books you find in game studies are basically all about understanding and analyzing and describing games and their effects and what people do with them and what they do with people. So as a designer, it's obvious that you look into the literature and say, this is not really helpful for me. But that's in any field, right? The stuff that you read in human-computer interaction about software design is something that might be interesting to the researcher. But if I, as an interaction designer, look at most papers that get published at CHI or so, I say, I don't really get how this relates to the kind of day-to-day problems that I actually have and that I have to solve.
Okay, I get it. I partially disagree with that, in the sense that one of my maybe delusions is that, like from your kind of talks, one gets some, they're in a way they talk about anthropology, but also one gets very concrete ideas about how to design, how could you concretely refine your UI design for making it more effective.
I think that is an effect of the fact that I've worked as an interaction designer before, and before I kind of re-entered academia after my first studies.
Okay.
So therefore, that is basically me who, if I look at academic research and I'm interested in research questions and understanding the world, am always also interested then as kind of my second half. Kind of my Jekyll or Hyde, you choose which one. Then the Mr. Hyde comes along and says, yes, but what can I do with this as a designer? And then, so in my talks, I always try to speak to that bit as well. And maybe that's the reason why, I mean, I'm very happy if that's the case, if you say that actually gives me good ideas. And there are some kind of, there are a number of people who are bridging the two spheres, and you can usually tell if somebody is also a practitioner when they do some research work in the kinds of questions that they ask to begin with and in the way that they approach it. But that is not kind of the predominant, I'd say that's not that predominant in academia in general.
Okay. Well, this is really interesting thing. And now, usually when you talk, I mean, superficially, let's say the Sebastian Vettel being most well known, actually, by when I was preparing this podcast, I found out also other kinds of writings by you, but you're most known about bringing game ideas, techniques, and practices from the gaming to the non-gaming world. Mm-hmm. And so, but which parts of the gaming world do you find most inspiring?
So to me, things fall into two sides or two parts, which are part and parcel more and more. And this is what, if you would take a scholar like Roger Kawa, you would call them ludus and paideia, or I call them game and play. So I say basically to play a game, and to have the enjoyment and excitement of playing a game, you literally need both. You need a game, which is a designed artifact, and you need play as a specific activity, a specific mode of engaging with that artifact, right? Mm-hmm. In my research, I'm currently interviewing a lot of people who are doing different things than playing with games and see that the experience is very different. So people like gold farmers or video game journalists playing to review a game. It's a very different experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you ask me the question, what is kind of most fascinating, interesting, important for me in kind of taking game design insights into non-game, I say it, to me, it falls into these two large buckets. And the one bucket is playing and how do we get people into a playful mood? And the other bucket is the game as an artifact and how is it designed? How is it designed well? And the thing that I now find most helpful is something like Rap Coasters, or Ian Schreiber's or Daniel Cook's or whomever you want to take, the idea of game atoms, that they say, if we try to understand kind of the little bits and pieces or what's the most fundamental element, of a game in the same sense that, a linguist would ask, what's the most fundamental element of a language? For instance, and they say, well, it's a game atom. That is, it is a connection of a goal that somebody pursues, a set of actions someone can then take to pursue these goals, determined by certain rules, which actions are allowed and not allowed.
Hmm. So you're like searching a Chomsky grammar?
Yeah, the whole debate is called game grammar. So so that's very closely related, actually. Yeah. And so they say the game grammar is basically this goal, action, rules, and then feedback, where the rule system informs you how successful your action was in getting you closer to your goal or not. And that I find is a very helpful lens to look at any possible activity that can be supported by software or any activity actual as such. And then ask, okay, what's the goal action feedback loop here? And in what ways is it broken, or in what ways is it well designed? And then you can zoom in and say, okay, is goal setting supported, or do people get good, helpful feedback? And then you can look at all the different kinds of bits and pieces of good feedback design in games. But this kind of, this conceptual lens to put in kind of game atoms as glasses to look at something, mm-hmm. I find now the most helpful and interesting. Because then you can start to see things like, if you compare something like chess with something like office work, mm-hmm. and you immediately see why chess can be such a pleasant experience and office work is not. You say, well, sure, because chess has very clear goals and chess has very clear informational feedback with every move, where you see where you stand, whether you got closer to your goals. The actions you can take are very well defined. Mm-hmm. And there is a deep, interesting challenge emerging from this goal action feedback loop. Whereas in office work, the goals are usually fuzzy and competing. It can take months until you get some kind of feedback from your supervisor, how well or how badly you do. It's not actually clear what kinds of actions you can or should take in order to achieve your
No clear winning conditions.
No clear winning conditions or competing winning conditions, right? Often enough, you're in kind of double binds where Department A wants something of you and Department B wants something different of you. And now you're in the hassle having to navigate these two things. So that's kind of structurally, in terms of on the game side, in the game bucket, I think a very helpful conceptual tool on which you then can hang all the little design patterns, like on a Christmas tree, to look at an activity.
Mm-hmm. But now, of course, I mean, the Chomsky grammar analogy, that didn't end up, I mean, it's now, it never resulted in complete grammars. Actually, it ended up in a huge set of problems, but still probably very useful as a perspective on language, not as a complete model.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing. It's not that likely every game on the world would fit that model perfectly, but as you said, it's just pragmatically mm-hmm. a useful conceptual tool to use. So that doesn't say anything about whether it's kind of true on a platonic level or not. It's useful.
Okay.
Useful. Which is kind of a very American move to make. You know, I don't care whether it's true. It's useful.
Okay. Now, maybe it's linking to this. One quote which I found particularly interesting from your Paideia is Paideia is fun is just another word for learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a remarkable quote, because defining fun seems like an impossible task. But this sentence maybe sheds some new light on this very ambiguous term.
Which is not my phrase, obviously. Fun is just another word of learning is a quote I take from, mm-hmm. again, from Rev Koester. So there seems to be a Rev Koester theme here. In his theory of fun for game design. And what he means with that sentence is that if you look at what makes games fun and engaging, it's usually overcoming a specific challenge mm-hmm. That you couldn't overcome or couldn't master as a player before, right? Games are basically machines for producing new challenges for us. Jump that next chasm, beat that next monster, solve that next Sudoku puzzle, whatever. And he says the fun that arises from that is our growth in our skill of understanding the rule model of the game, or developing the skills of mastering that rule model. So at a certain point, I have become masterful at, I don't know, racing my car around a bend. I have become very masterful in solving Sudoku puzzles. And this good experience, if I master a challenge, that, I learned something. I grokked the game system more, Koester says, is the core of what makes games fun and engaging. Although I would hasten to add, it's arguably the most important part, but definitely the pleasures of games are much more diverse and varied around that.
Mm-hmm. Also, the notion of challenge used in this kind of definition is a specific notion, because it's a sort of safe challenge.
Yeah, that to me comes to the kind of to the other bucket, to the play bucket, to how do people approach or encounter or engage with games, right? The safety is nothing that is inherent to the game as an object, which you can see in poker, right? You can play poker and in the end just say, well, it has all just been, you know, plastic tokens. Or you can say at the end, well, and now all the plastic tokens are exchanged into cash for real.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's a great observation. It can be real.
Yeah. So this, the idea that there is, that it is a safe challenge, that is a challenge where you don't really hurt yourself or your sense of self-worth or ego, even if it's not physical harm. There's also no psychological potential harm involved if you don't make it.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that doesn't have that much to do with the actual, game itself, though, if you see people playing, then usually, I don't know, you know, they use foam swords if they play live action role playing rather than real metal swords because of that partially. So there's a bit design in there, but predominantly it's about what the people that congregate to play the game determine that activity to be. That is play. That is, we do this and it doesn't matter what the outcome is, right? It's the same thing when you would do, say, when you would be in school and there would be a school test for real, and now kind of your outcome in that test would be your actual grade. But the teacher could just as well say, well, actually, this test is just a test run. I don't care about your results in the test. They don't get translated into some real consequence afterwards.
That's you in a particular state of mind where you're sort of playing both parts at the same time.
No? How do you mean that? Both parts at the same time?
In the sense, if you're in a class and a teacher tells you that, in a parts of you feels the challenge, the real one, the same as it would be real, and another part. And in fact, I remember these situations, and they're bizarre.
I think a bit of that is also likely in that situation. Can I really trust that teacher?
Yeah.
Or will he, in the end, not actually take, I don't know, my test results and translate them into my grades somehow? So, and that actually that surfaces another crucial element. That kind of social safety space, which is play, is essentially always a space of mutual trust. People have to trust each other that everyone involved in playing has engaged in that with a benign intent, with the intent of having fun together with the other persons, and not to be a spoil sport or to be in online terms a troll or a griefer. Somebody who is there in order to hurt other people.
So in the case of a group of professional poker players, until they're really having fun, but when they don't, is it a game anymore?
Well, it is. That's in a way that only qualitative research can do. The answer to that was given in one beautiful little sentence by one of my interview participants. Which was a game designer. No, actually, she was a game producer, who sometimes had to play games of competitors in order to analyze them, understand, okay, what are they doing different, and can we learn something from that? And when I asked her to describe that experience, she said, "Well, it was a game, but I did not play it." And I think that kind of describes the poker player, or can describe the poker player situation as well. That you say, well, it's a game that we're engaging with, but it's not playful what we're doing anymore. What we do here is now very focused, instrumental in the way that a regular job would be, because we're professional. And you see the same thing with professional athletes. Essentially, they report the same thing, right? They get into a sport because they enjoy it. They enjoy the experience. Then they get professional. And then at a certain point in time, with all the social structures and the competitions and the rewards around that, and the fact that this is now their livelihood, something that was play transforms into something that now has become their work. And then you get these kind of people reporting once they retire. Only then do they really recover the initial joy they had in the activity in the first place, right? Golfers who say, now that I have stopped playing golf professionally, finally I'm beginning to enjoy golf again.
Mm-hmm. It's like the highest, it's like, it reminds me of Kahneman, the highest peak of emotion is what you actually remember afterwards. So. Yeah. Okay, now another theme. You wrote a very interesting article. I think it's a draft from which talks about going from board, how we moved from board games to video games.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us briefly how did that happen? And In fact, you're using in this article at the concept of board to screen remediations. What is a remediation?
So basically that article came about because I have been a board gamer and an avid board game geek and a live role playing gamer long before I started getting interested in video games. And when I was looking at video role playing games, to me as a pen and paper role playing gamer, or video games just in general, to me as a pen and paper role playing gamer and somebody who also knows miniature wargaming, it was immediately apparent that I said, wait a minute, there are so many concepts that video games just directly took from board games, right? Such basic concepts like, I don't know, movement points or hit points or the idea that people have character traits or skills like strength or stamina or something, right? To me as a board gamer and pen and paper role playing gamer, it was immediately clear to say, oh, these are elements that they directly took from offline games.
Yeah.
But nobody seemed to have made that argument.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was then reading some histories of video games, there are a couple of historical works on how did video games come about. In Germany, Klaus Pias, Henry Lovud, and colleagues in the United States. You notice that the kind of story that they tell is usually a story where they say, well, the reasons why video games are as they are and the reasons why they are so kind of mathematical and splitting things up into these kind of traits and so on, that's because they're computing technology. And the reason games are the way they are, video games are the way they are, is that they share this kind of this computing
algorithmic core.
Yeah, technology at its core, and that was developed in the 1960s as part of kind of the military academic complex back in the Cold War. And so we see how video games are basically a flow or directly come out of that. And so with my experience or my memory as a board gamer and role-playing gamer, I said, wait a minute. A lot of the aspects that I see in video games are not there just because of the technology. The technology works beautifully to support these.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only logical that once computers came along, somebody would say, hey, we can computerize wargaming or we can computerize role playing. But kind of the underlying ideas of how you would model and simulate reality, in game terms, were there already a long time ago. And that was then kind of the argument in that article I try to make by looking specifically at the history of war games, to really look into the actual historical detail and show, by the way, if you look very closely, you find that the way the military module simulated understood war back in the 50s and so already had a long history of board wargaming before that. And when they started to computerize things, what they did, just like the video game industry itself did when it was growing or essentially coming into existence, was taking board game designers, miniature war game board game designers, and have them build their first computer games.
So not just the ideas, even the real people.
The ideas were transported by the real people.
Okay.
Exactly. And that was kind of the kind of historical argument where, if you look into this detail, I hope to show this kind of, wait a minute, for video games in general, a lot of what we see is not so much due to the technology just supports it, but it's due to previous games that, to use that term, got remediated, where a previous medium, a previous
okay.
medium gets kind of uptaken and transformed by a new medium. In that case, board games were remediated, taken up, and transformed by computing technology.
So like remodeling it, okay. So transforming.
Yeah. And the argument there, or the underlying concept of remediation by, so it's a term coined by Volter and Cruzan, who are both media theorists, who said, if we see the way that, say, movies picked up still images and theater, or if we see the way that television picked up movies, or if we see the way that new media today pick up the old media, that remediation process usually has two sides to it. The one side is what they call immediacy, where the new medium tries to be more life, more immediate, more realistic, more detailed, more in your face. And at the same time, hypermediacy, where the new medium kind of enjoys the fact of showing you a pastiche and traces of the old medium technology. Kind of the same thing you see today with Instagram. Instagram is basically that kind of hypermediacy of old photography, in them kind of simulating all of these filters or old film material.
Mm-hmm. Well, the quote that you make there, that the every media sort of builds up, it's a wrapper of another media. It's very illuminating.
Yeah.
Now the fact that but there is also another side of this, is the fact that when you're mock-upping, doing prototyping of video games, it's often very useful to build a board game, a paper version of the video game. In fact, this can lead to very usable interfaces. And because it forces you to simplify the algorithmic part and to represent everything very explicitly. And one example for me, I find a great example, is Memoir 44, where the board game and the online game are both extremely usable and have somehow approached many people to war games in a very simple setting. And there's also the other way around, like in card games, like deck building games. They used to be with the physical cards, but now they're like more and more video game deck building or using card game mechanics, and some of them use this simplifying concept, but some of them it would not possible to play them on paper because of some underlying, like one example is Six Gun Saga, or there are more.
Yeah, I perfectly agree. I mean, that's a general, on the one hand, that's a general design rule, right? If you have the chance, prototype lo-fi as much as possible before you're kind of moving into more high fidelity renditions. And that usually means start doodling or start doing something with paper or with clay or with whatever before you move into the digital sphere. And that's it in interaction design. In the interaction design discourse, there is that recurring idea or observation, which I perfectly subscribe, that is, once you present something in high detail, once you present a visual design that is beautifully done and in all details, people will start focusing and talking about and criticizing only the detail. I don't like this hue of green that much. Could we use maybe another hue of green? Rather than asking kind of the more general and more structural questions. Is it actually any good that we place a video clip on the top of this page, or shouldn't there be some other kind of content?
In fact, there's a UI design tool which is built exactly on this consideration, which is Balsamiq, and in fact, it doesn't allow you to refine the user interface mockup. It's very rough, and it's been a huge success, in fact.
Yeah, and I think that just kind of shows that, and I think for video games it's the same thing. People get so quickly kind of blinded by the visuals and start focusing on the visuals or on good 3D game engines, instead of asking, well, is the game design or the actual game mechanics any fun? And to find out whether the game mechanics are working well, you don't need those visuals, in fact, you will waste a huge amount of resources, potentially, refining and redoing high fidelity game assets or anything, only to discover the first time that you can actually play your game that what you came up with as a game idea is no good at all, and you have to throw it all away. So in that sense, it's kind of another field where software design, in terms of agile design, build a running prototype and see that whatever you do always results in a running prototype or in running software that people can use and give you useful feedback on, which is one bit of the agile philosophy. And where that kind of, again, meshes very well with game design, where the idea that you can't tell whether a game is actually any fun or not without playing it. So therefore, you have to work your way from prototype to prototype.
So that's an advice for game designers. And a final question. It's simply, I mean, which it's more personal question. I mean, which games you particularly like, and which games you find a game designer should try to get a feeling of good UI design, good game design?
Oh, that's a nasty question. Oh boy, the really, 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 really nasty question. I'll circumnavigate that question a bit by saying, the game I most enjoyed, thoroughly enjoyed, was, Nerf Gun Zombiecalypse recently, which is a live game played with Nerf guns. So these guns, which are basically not paint ball guns, but guns that shoot little foam darts, which fly like 2 or 3 meters.
Oh.
And then basically one half of the players, have Nerf guns and they're the humans. The other half are the zombies. The zombies move like zombies. And each zombie has a number of hit points of darts. And then the zombie goes down for 3 seconds and then stands up again. And the zombies can beat the humans, bite the humans. And if they bite a human, if they touch them, and can manage to hold on to that human for 3 seconds, making the sound yum 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 yum. They're supposed to have eaten their brain, and then the human turns into a zombie. Whereas the humans have one healer who, if a zombie is shot down for 3 seconds, managed to hold the kind of healing serum against the zombie for those 3 seconds. The zombie is then turned into a human. And I think in terms of good game design, that thing actually has a wealth of lessons, apart from the fact that it's just a wonderful, hugely enjoyable social game to play. Like board games, it opens itself up to constant tinkering. And that, I think, is the most important experience you can make as a game designer. So people would constantly, after each round, say, now let's change the rules a bit. Now let's say the zombies have 3 points instead of 2 hit points, because the humans were at such an advantage in the last round that it wasn't really fun. It didn't really last very long. They were overpowering us that quickly. And then you do the 3 hit points and you find, now actually the zombies are too strong. So let's say some zombies are tanks and they have 5 hit points and the others have 2. So you're constantly in the flow, in the moment, in reaction to how everybody feels in the play, trying to come up with new interesting variations that keep the whole experience interesting and that keep the whole experience balanced on whoever is playing it. So apart from this being a very good workout and B, terrible good fun, I'd also say that for being a game designer, it holds very it's a very formative experience.
Okay. Well, that's a really fun suggestion. Thank you, Sebastian, for being on the European Video Gamer podcast.
My pleasure.
And I hope we'll have you again soon.
Sure, anytime.
So here. you soon. Bye.
Bye.